Welcome to Jumbi, a podcast all about the monsters that even colonialism couldn't kill. Jumbi is a Creole word from the Caribbean that encompasses all spirits and demons that haunt the multitude of cultures that converge there. On this podcast, we're going to hear dark and haunting stories from local storytellers that are inspired by or about the spirits, monsters, and other cryptids that people surviving colonialism have used to process the horrors inflicted on their communities. This podcast was originally recorded in the fall of 2021, with several episodes originally released between October and December. That original season featured contributions from an individual whose values don't coincide with the intentions of this podcast. However, the stories and insights from those storytellers, including those that have yet to be released, are too valuable not to be shared. The following season of Jumbi has been re-edited to put the focus on the storytellers and the lessons they can teach us. So check your locks, look under your beds, and in your closets, because you're about to listen to Jumbi, Colonized Monsters.
On this episode, we have Ryan Persati. Ryan Persati is a queer artist, educator, and writer based in Toronto. His work interrogates relationships between queer Indo-Caribbean diasporas, Caribbean feminisms, and legacies of indenture within performance, embodiment, and popular culture. This is Ryan Persati, or Tifa Wine, with The Trial.
Trial by Tifa Wine. The spirit or Jumbi of a long-gone indentured laborer whose life, and in some cases child's life as well, was cut too short is known in the Indo-Caribbean as a churail. In Guyana, she's also referred to as a boot or a vampiric supernatural being that lives on in the physical world as the ghost of a harmed deceased Kuli woman. In some stories, she is noted as being killed during childbirth through the act of giving life into the world, while others note she committed suicide during pregnancy for reasons we do not know. In other oral traditions, the child continues to live while the mother has died. In this moment of passing, the churail is so enraged that she cannot be with her child. She cannot rest peacefully, and instead, the separation from her child disrupts her spirit so much that her condition is consumed by anger that can only be expressed through inflicting harm upon other mothers. The churail is usually depicted in tattered clothing, long black messy hair that drapes her face, caught in eternal grief and sorrow, longing for the child that was so painfully taken away from her. She often dresses in all white, holding her unborn baby in her arms, and in the depths of the night, by straining to hear, it has been found that she wails sorrowfully as the unborn child cries into the night and into her. The churail is unable to pass into the next world, eternally damaged by the lingering and haunting grief that only the loss of a child can bring. In Guyana, the terror of the churail is in her disguise. She looks like any other Kuli woman, only decipherable by her feet, which if you can glance upon them are turned backwards, and in other cases flipped upside down. The churail is capable of adapting her form, specifically using conventional beauty to lure lusty men into her arms. It is said that the churail seeks revenge on women and men alike, but especially targets abusive men and ones who seek to harm pregnant Caribbean women. Tales in Trinidad and Guyana noted that her favorite victim is the pregnant woman who she haunts and possesses. Her jealousy is unimaginable as she creeps, maps, and traces the joy of Caribbean mothers as they experience that which the churail so desperately desires. Her being is solely attached to feelings of dangerous envy and inconsolable trauma. Her choice of inflicting harm is said to take the form of causing pregnant women to miscarry, while also harming the father of these children through inflicting illness. The churail also disputes absent fathers and those who were and are abusive to the bearers of life, working to destroy those who even attempt to neglect their offspring. Churails can be found in many places in the Caribbean, but most often can be spotted at a field, near the water, or at a crossroads. Often tied to the traumas of the plantation, the churail wanders and her voice carries through the night to those looking for her. However, once she is found, it is largely impossible to outsmart her. Those who have encountered her have said that crossing water or leaving shoes behind you will save you, as churails do not move through water and instead will spend all night trying to put on shoes that they cannot maneuver with their unforgiving feet. My dad is from San Fernando, Trinidad and Tobago. I'm mixed race, so my mom is actually not Caribbean. She's from Portugal. But I grew up a lot with my cousins on my dad's side and with my grandparents on both sides, but spent a lot of time with my Trini family doing things like going to Soca Fats, you know, like basement jams, you know, all those sorts of things. Chief of Wine is literally like a middle-aged tanti. So a lot of my work speaks back to the Caribbean and the queer Caribbean and the Indo-Caribbean and sort of the sort of archives of knowledge that all those spaces hold. I knew of Charles before, but as I was just saying, I don't come from a Hindu or a Muslim Indo-Caribbean family, which is often like the mainstream kind of dominant representation you often have. So my grandparents were like very, very pious Christians. And it was actually interesting because they always had this, not all of them, but they had this sort of disdain toward Hindu communities. Like it was almost like, and I think it's a lot of that is internalized colonialism about we're not like those people, don't be like those people. And I think for them, maybe Hindus represented a kind of backwards, indentured, historical, coolie past. Whereas, you know, especially in the context of Trinidad, a lot of Christians were forcibly converted by the British in order to socially mobilize, right? So your marriage was not legible in Trinidad for like decades, and unless you were Christian, therefore meaning your children would not be legible citizens, right? A lot of people, especially in San Fernando, were actually converted. It's actually really wild that I'm also in Canada now because the Canadian Presbyterian Church was the one that converted all these coolies. So it's kind of interesting now to like be born and raised in Canada. And so Canada's always kind of had their foot in the door. Like my grandma, she only mentioned it once. She used to like come to my parents' house when I was a teenager, and she would like spend like a week with us, like during Easter or like whatever. We would just like hang out, and she would just like tell me all these stories. And like this was just kind of like a passing sort of thing, but she was also a very God-fearing person. So I think it was more with the aim of being like, you know, like, don't be bad. Like, she used to always say to me, like, are you acting proper? Like, that was, like, always her language. And that was also, I think, coding for, like, don't be gay. But, like, also, I think it was to do with respectability and, like, modesty and sort of these very, like, Christian and very, I want to say, like also, like, coolie masculinity ways of being, like, a boy or being a man or what she understood as being a man, right? But I remember hearing these stories throughout a realm, you know, of, like, fear and paranoia and not so much as, like, oh, this is, like, really creepy and cool. It was also like when I was thinking about the trial, I remember, and this is, you know, trigger warning, this is very anti-Black, but I remember I had one aunt who was Dogla, meaning for anyone who doesn't know that she has mixed Black and Indian ancestry in the Caribbean. And I remember like when my grandfather died, like her husband, there was this one, and I'd never seen her before, never met this woman before, but apparently she had met me when I was like a month old and like she knew who I was. But I remember my grandma like fully pulled me aside and she was like, be careful with that woman. And I was like, what are you talking about? And she was like, she does jadu. And I was like, what? Because I just thought it was so ridiculous for it to hear this like word come out of my grandmother's mouth, who was like super religious, super Christian. And she was like, oh no, like she does witchcraft, like be careful with her. But I remember like going to my dad after, and I was like, I used to call my grandma Ma, right? So I was like, why did Ma say that? And he was like, oh, she just makes stuff up all the time. But like, she was really serious. I think a lot of it also had to do with anti-Blackness because most of her generation of people married other coolie people. And so I think there was an era of like direct anti-Black racism that comes with that, as do many stories in the Caribbean. But yeah, it was just interesting to kind of hear that language come out of her mouth, and I was just like, whoa. And she kind of, when I was thinking about the trial, I was like, she never fully said trial, but this kind of witchy figure, you know, she would kind of hit it here and there. It was super strange to hear, like at a funeral, like of all places. So I produced this series, I think I started in 2019 or maybe 2018, where I was thinking through this sort of paradox or this juxtaposition of pain and pleasure that I think is like really central to Caribbean lived realities right now. And particularly when I started thinking about this, I was thinking about really real issues in our community. And this is the wider Caribbean community, but I also was thinking specifically through the queer Caribbean and sort of this sort of marginalizations and struggles that are happening right now. And one of them for me was domestic abuse and gendered violence that happens in specifically Indo-Caribbean communities. Just last week, another woman was killed by an intimate partner in the GTA. And I was seeing this happen again and again and again. Like my work as an academic really fueled my work as a drag artist. Like they went hand in hand, because as I was doing research for my own scholarly work, I was mind blown by all these historical connections between the past and the present that really haven't escaped us. Right. And so I was reading this one book by Gayatri Bahadur, who's a journalist in New York City. The book is called Coolie Woman. Right. I mean, we can also talk about this language of coolie. A lot of people don't like the word. I find the word is really important in the diaspora for thinking about, again, this juxtaposition of pain and pleasure, but also reclamation and power and agency that's particularly rooted in Caribbean feminist sort of knowledges. Right. Where Caribbean feminist women whether they identify that way or not, have always been at the forefront of teaching us what it means to reclaim your body, to mash up the space, to free up yourself. But all of these ideas around free up are also loaded in pain, right? And so this, in enacting pleasure, we have to also think through what pain has been caused to allow that pleasure to happen, right? And so I was really interested in like images of the horror and the grotesque and the paranormal to help us think through those sorts of intimacies and those sorts of relationships. And so, you know, when I was thinking about the trial, I was thinking specifically about, you know, the ways in which Afro and Indo-Caribbean women have always been rendered as carnal or aggressive in different racialized capacities, right? But have been aggressive, carnal, over the top, unruly, whatless, like all these terms have been used to describe Caribbean women because they have been seen as sort of the antithesis or the opposite of the normative white femininity, right? And specifically the Tanti, right? Like I'm obsessed with Tantis because they're unruly. They will like tell you you're fat. They will like come for you, but then they will also like fight for you the hardest, right? A Tanti, I guess for anyone who's Caribbean knows what that word means, but it's really just an anti-figure. I literally have this like article called Tanti Feminisms to think about. A Tanti can be made like through a best friend or through a cousin, or it can be like a queer and trans person who has like, who's an elder in your life, right? That works through this archive of like strong and assertive femininity, right? In a particular way. I was interested in all of these sorts of tropes of resilience and revolutionary practice that are like rooted in the queer Caribbean. And I'm just using figures that are scary to talk about that because I think they're really central to kind of Caribbean knowledge systems. And when we think about strong, fierce, you know, queer creators or queer figures in the Caribbean, they often take the shape of the Tanti or take the shape of someone like the Chirayal. And like, if we were to read the Chirayal as a source of Indo-Caribbean or queer Caribbean or just Caribbean feminist knowledge, like what would she offer to us in those conversations? I'm from Mississauga, and so like there weren't really any drag bars to go to. But I mean, I was always in like, you know, I was like an arts kid, I was in music and drama, so I was always really obsessed with like makeup and fashion and like exuberance and extraness and like all those sorts of things. And so then when I just saw drag, I was like, okay, there's something really exciting about what is happening there, because also the drag artists I cling to are like not people who adhere to like traditional femininity or like cis understandings of what gender is. Like, my favorite drag queen of all time is Nina Flowers. If anyone knows who she is, she was on season one of Drag Race and like doesn't look like any conventional gendered person whatsoever, right? Like is bald, has a bunch of tattoos, but her like eye makeup is half her face, super heavy contours. I'm like, that's the drag that I like. That is like extra and exuberant and hyperbolic and really fucks with gender in a lot of ways and notions of what we think gender is. And so, yeah, I literally started doing drag just like in my bedroom. Like there was like no really where to go to do it at the time. And I just would like take pictures. And then when I moved back to Toronto, I would like go to bars and stuff for fun. And then, yeah, literally I started performing because an organizer, I hope she doesn't hate me for putting her up here, but Anuradha Verma, who runs Cutie by Puck Saga, was organizing a show. And literally my first gig was at Pride Toronto, which is wild because most queens or kings or artists go to like open stages. And she was like, do you want to perform in front of like 200 people? And I was like, sure. I don't know what I was doing. But I did this whole, like, what was the number? You know the song Pipe? The Soca song Pipe? But the whole song is literally, like, do you want some pipe? Do you want some pipe? It's, like, a play on, like, dick, basically. And again, it was from a woman's voice. And so this, like, hyper-excessive sexuality was, like, literally my first number. And then, yeah, from there, I just, like, my work became really entangled with my research work. And so, you know, I'm really committed to doing, like, educational spaces and outreach and community engagement and that sort of thing. As well as, you know, performing in the clubs. And the clubs are an important space as well. But I think in the city too, the clubs sometimes miss the sort of radical potential of drag. Well, that's the thing. You have to like, there's only certain sorts of numbers you can do in the clubs. And especially in the spaces that you're in. So most of the spaces I perform in are usually not in the village. I think I performed in the village maybe like 5 times on my whole like 5-year career. Most of the spaces I do are like, you know, with other like-minded political thinkers and performers. There aren't that many like Indo-Caribbean drag artists in Toronto, but I have seen, there's a lot of storytellers. So like a lot of my work that I was, when I was trying to understand and put together this photograph was like, again, I had to go back to the oral traditions that mostly are rooted in the Caribbean, right? So it's very hard to find writing in the trial. And most of them are like from like blogs or like stories mm-hmm. or oral traditions that like people have told. And so like when I did that picture, there was a person in the Caribbean that was like, oh no, your trial was like very like glamorous. Because she was like, when I heard of the trial, like the trial is supposed to be like messy and like ugly and like haunted and all these sorts of things. And so, you know, mine was a very kind of diasporic drag imagining of what the trial would look like. you know, I was wearing, like, you know, like a synthetic wig and, like, glitter and, like, all these sorts of things. But again, the Jor-El can, you know, is obviously a manifestation of people's imagination. I also have never met one in real life, and I don't know if I want to. So it's kind of my kind of reading based on my research and people's stories. But there's a lot of people, I think, that have always been interested in the horrific, right? And the grotesque as a kind of political resource. Particularly, I think, for me, I mean, I did the Sukhoyan, I did the Jor-El, and then I, like, also made up some characters. But it was to help us to think about particularly Caribbean feminism and what, you know, decolonial efforts and lessons of the Caribbean offers us. So, you know, when I was thinking about the Jor-El, I was like, it's also this representative metaphor for the ways in which women of color in the Caribbean have been, again, rendered as, like, too much, excessive, too loud, in need of regulation and control. And the Jor-El is uncontrollable, mm-hmm. right? Like, she doesn't give a fuck about men, right? And so that kind of was my lesson, too, to, like, to think through that archive of Caribbean womanhood and femininity and gendering that has always been fierce and in your face and over the top, and which is really, I think, important for, especially for me as, like, a cis queer person to draw upon that legacy. I think in my work too, I try and get away from this whole, like, home away sort of binary, right? Like, in that I don't want to play into discourse that's like, we're in Canada, therefore we're not real Caribbeans, therefore, you know, we're inauthentic. Because all those sorts of diaspora wars I just find are really exhausting. Mm-hmm. And it's just identity politics. And so, you know, I'm also of the training that the Caribbean is made far beyond the territories of the Caribbean, right? And the diaspora is part of the Caribbean always. Like a city like Toronto is a Caribbean city, right? You know, when we think about like soca, like so many soca artists come here in New York to like to record their music and then go back and tour all over the world. And so I don't see Toronto as separated from the Caribbean. Obviously, the lives people are living here are different, and I don't want to say they're the same, but I think we've always been in conversation with one another, and I think that's really the important work of doing these sorts of things, because it helps us to make those connections that are outside of, like, one place as the authentic Caribbean and here as the inauthentic. My work sometimes troubles people, because I also don't give a fuck about India, and I never have, and I know I think a lot of people who hear the word Kuli, especially, like, I don't know, certain communities have more of an attachment, I think, to, like, the motherland, whatever you want to call mm-hmm. that. But, you know, in my work, too, I always talk about how Indo-Caribbeanness is made in our departure from India, right? Mm-hmm. And so that may also be because of my own political training for the people that have trained me, but also because I'm someone whose father is, like, fifth, sixth, I don't even know, but he's, like, five or six generations removed from India. And so, like, we had no connection. Also, my grandparents, like, didn't care about India. They would really never say, like, they're Indians. They would always say they're Trinis, right? Yeah. And not to, like, buy into, like, nationalist politics, but also I think that helps us to get away from this, like, trauma porn stuff that's really pervasive in, like, Indo-Caribbean, diasporic, whatever. Like, there are so many blogs and things that are like, we need to go back to India, and it's like, they never wanted us. And so I think that's why also the work is called Kuli Ween, because I really want to honor the labor diaspora that we come out of, yeah. right? That is so... that is literally built on the backs of those who are, that were indentured laborers, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think we forget that, like, we descend from, like, sex workers and people who were criminalized and hyper-policed and hyper-surveilled. Like, we didn't come from, like, lavish, like, Bollywood-esque, like, lehenga-wearing, you know? Like, it's, like, so weird when I see these images of even, like, Indian Arrival Day, where, like, people were, like, wearing lehengas, and I'm like, our people didn't wear that. Mm-hmm. Like, they were not wearing that. I think it's really important to center, like, the history of the Kuli, because... we are not the same as sort of this, like, South Asian national imagination. Also, India's a fascist state. So yeah. I don't know why we're trying to, like, fit into something that has never given a care about us, but also is working to, like, harm people all across the continent. And yeah, and I'm like, I think we really need to center more about labor in our conversations of Indo-Caribbeans, because we only come to the region through labor, mm-hmm. right? And through the work of particular types of communities. I think there are a lot of people doing this work in different capacities. I would say, like, a lot of my sort of, like, when I think about storytelling, I don't necessarily think about, I mean, there's oral traditions that I draw upon, but oftentimes those oral traditions come to me from my own family, or they come to me through, like, research that I've done. I mean, I'm also, like, a music person, and, like, soca and chutney is always, like, the knowledge carrier for so much of the things that I do. And I think it's also because, as a drag artist, I predominantly perform soca and chutney. And so I think about all these sort of political stories that are deeply embedded in this art form that often gets cast as, like, very apolitical and, like, joyful and fun-loving, and but it's deeply, deeply, like, revolutionary. And so I think, yeah, a lot of my sort of, I guess, genealogy of storytelling comes through that sort of archive as well. The thing is, I feel like sometimes in doing this work is cool. I mean, like, I don't know that many people doing it. especially through drag, right? There's a writer who's actually a friend of mine based in Scarborough named Natasha Ramutar, who's Guyanese. I think she just published a book, a poetry collection last year. Bittersweet, so she's amazing. We actually just wrote a piece together for the Starbrook News, I think 2 weeks ago. She's really great. Also, Rahma is really great, who does a lot of work with like Chutney poetry. Alia Khan is an academic who does really, really great work with sort of these archives of indenture. I really enjoy her work too. But yeah, I think there's a ton of people working in like different capacities that are really, all really critical in doing the work. So most of my stuff is on Instagram at tifa.wine. I'm also on Twitter as at @RaiPrasadi. And I also have a website, my academia website, if anyone's interested in research.
You're listening to Jumbi. Produced and edited by Dev Ramsewa. Music by Z Thompson. Sound effects are Creative Commons sounds from freesound.org. Thanks for joining us. And don't forget to check those dark, shadowy corners.